Tonight, we're going to start a new study on the book of Galatians, but we're not going to get into Galatians tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about the background that's necessary to understand the book. The book of Galatians is a powerful book in the history of the church. A couple studies ago, we were talking about different personalities through the church history lessons that we were looking at. And Martin Luther really did love this book. And in many ways, it was the spark for the Protestant Reformation. So, what we're going to encounter in this letter that is attributed to Paul is a lot of new ideas that are beginning to emerge at the beginning stages of the church. And what we're going to find is that in this book, there's an emphasis upon grace, and that's why I'm calling this Grace Point for our study. And we'll be in this study probably for about 3 months, I imagine. We're going to try to take a couple of chapters, a couple of lessons for each chapter. And so there's six chapters, so that will equal out to about 12 lessons in total. We'll probably have a couple of breaks here and there, but we will be done by the end of the summer in this particular study. So what I want us to do tonight is get an overview of this book. And to do that, I want to give you an introduction, not just to the book of Galatians, but to the backdrop of the New Testament as well. So when you open your Bible and you turn to the New Testament, you're going to find that the Gospels are first, and then you have the letters of Paul, and then you have the non-Pauline letters, and then it closes off with the book of Revelation. Now, most people, when they open a book, they think that because you're starting at a particular point A and working toward the end, that that's kind of the way it unfolded in time. And that's not true, though, in the New Testament. The canonical New Testament makes sense the way it is organized in the sense that it begins with the stories of Jesus as found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John actually come after the time of some of the earliest letters of the New Testament. And I'm going to talk about that in a moment. And the letters of Paul are kind of arranged according to size. So you have Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians, which are his biggest letters. And then it's followed by the other letters, the various prison epistles and the pastoral epistles as well. The thing to keep in mind here is even though that's the way the New Testament is organized, it can be misleading. And I understand why it was organized that way, but there are seven letters of Paul that are the earliest writings of the New Testament, and they are actually written long before some of the gospel writings. And I'll show you that in a couple of moments in one of the slides where I have a chart. But when you begin to look at seven of the letters of Paul, what you're finding is the ongoing movement of the Spirit in these early Christian communities that begins to spread across the Roman Empire. And these seven letters are windows, in many respects, into the very early Christian communities, those that began meeting in synagogues and those that began to break off and meet in homes. What you're going to find is that the Gospels, in many respects, are a product of these communities, not the other way around. So a lot of times we think of the Gospels, these churches began because of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but that's not the case. You'll find that these Christian communities actually begin and there is the necessity as time goes along to put some of these traditions and memories into into a form of writing that can be referenced for a multitude of different communities. So when we think of the New Testament, we think of these books. So there are 27 books of the New Testament. I want to kind of alter that a little bit. I think it's better to think in terms of documents rather than books. First, in terms of size, these letters that we read, none of them are very long in comparison to a published book that goes on Barnes & Noble shelf. In a modern sense of the term, we can call them books, but they really are documents. And having that in mind, what you can see on your screen there is that there's not one New Testament author that actually published their works. They wrote a letter, they sent it to a Christian community, and it was written specifically for them. Later, some of these letters will be copied and distributed to other locations. But in reality, what you find is that when someone writes a book, they usually have it published for people they don't know. They're hoping that people will be attracted to the title or the subject matter and then will purchase it. In the New Testament, you have these letters that are written for people either by acquaintance or by real deep knowledge. And there's a mixture of both depending upon what letter we're looking at. It's also important to remember that when these letters are written in the New Testament, the majority of the people listened to these letters. They didn't read it. Many of the people in the New Testament first century were pre-literate. And so to actually try to publish something would not only be a waste of time, but it would be quite expensive to do so because all of this correspondence would have had to be copied by hand and delivered by some type of individual that would travel maybe a good distance to deliver it. Like when we studied the book of Romans, Phoebe takes this letter all the way to Rome. And you can see the considerable cost that it would entail to do something like that. So we're just trying to clarify in our mind before we get into the book what we're dealing with here. So when I talk about books of the New Testament, just keep in mind that it's probably better to reference them as documents, documents that can be rolled up and can be carried by someone from one place to the next, written on some type of papyrus that would be handwritten. So any questions on that so far? So when you think a little bit about the context of all letters, but in particular, before we get into Galatians, you have three concentric circles that are important to keep in mind. The context of Paul's letters kind of go from the center out. And what I mean by that is a letter that is sent to the Galatian church is being addressed to a local community that is in a specific geographical location. Now, in the New Testament, most of the documents are titled by their destination, the letter to the Romans, the letter to the Corinthians, the letter to the Thessalonians, the letter to the Galatians. So these are very specific geographical areas. These are very specific communities of people, and they don't all necessarily share the same context culturally. There's unique cultures, just like in the United States. You have a Midwest culture, you have a Southern culture, you have a West Coast culture, and there's even subcultures below that. And even though We all share a common citizenship in this country. There's a lot of uniqueness to where particular communities are. And to have an understanding of that is to have an understanding of how to navigate in that particular arena. So within those local communities, you have another concentric circle. The New Testament letters, except for the book of Romans, really are centered throughout an area where there are primarily Jewish people. It doesn't necessarily have to be in Jerusalem or Judea, but as you move on through Asia Minor and even all the way over to Philippi and Corinth and that type of thing, there's a pretty good population of Jewish people. Many of them are diaspora type Jews that are in different locales other than the homeland. But Judaism is in the background all the time. Now, within that concentric circle, you have these communities. So what we're going to find in the book of Galatians is these two circles are very closely knit together. The local community in Galatia is going to wrestle with the Judaism and the rites and ceremonies of Judaism and how much is still required and how much has been fulfilled by Jesus, how much of it has been dismissed and is no longer relevant. So now you have local communities, then you have Judaism as a culture, and then those two concentric circles are within the circle of the Roman Empire. So there's no one that is written to in the New Testament that's not under the rule of the Roman Empire. And that's also in the background all the time. It's sometimes found in the vocabulary that is used. It's sometimes found in some of the things that are referenced within the letters and so forth. So just try to keep in mind these three concentric circles, the local community that has a geographical location, that's within Judaism, and Judaism is within the rule of the Roman Empire. So we always have to take note of that when we're reading anything in the New Testament. Okay. Context also is very important to keep in mind in terms of a distinction with background. Now, here's what I mean by that. Context is different than background. So we'll begin next week talking a little bit about the background that produced the book of Galatians. But that is different than the context. The context is the world that brings these three concentric circles together, the local community, the Judaism, and the Roman Empire. And it's sort of like a fish that's swimming in water. It's there all the time. That's what they, that's where they move. Context is interactive. And what I mean by that is Judaism interacts with the Roman Empire that interacts with the local congregation. So all of these things are working at the same time. In other words, a local congregation, if it has a synagogue, has the presence of Judaism, but that's being controlled by the Roman Empire. And all of these things are interworking. And we need to kind of keep that in mind because it tells us how people kind of saw things. In other words, context is like the air that they breathed. And there is these moments that you come to in the reading of any document in the New Testament where you go, where did that come from? Boy, that was kind of out of the blue type thing. And it's because of the context that they're living in. Now, background is a different thing. A specific background that produced the letter to the Galatians comes out of the fact that Paul travels into Galatia on his first missionary journey, establishes some churches there. He's writing back to them. All of that is kind of specific background information. But context is something that is more It is wider in scope. So I give you an example here on the screen. The book of Revelation tells us what some early Christians thought would happen in their time, and not necessarily what would happen sometime in the future. Now, here we are 2,000 years later, and we tend to look at the book of Revelation, or some Christians tend to look at the book of Revelation, as something that is entirely in the future, that it's going to be fulfilled at some point in the future. That's not the way the seven churches to whom the book of Revelation is written would have seen it. It had to do within their own day, their own context, and their own situation. And what they would do is they would have to think in terms of what does this mean to us as a local congregation in Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, some of the other ones that are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3. So you have to keep that in mind. You can't fast forward and look to the future immediately. Are there elements that still await? Yeah, but that's not the way that they would have thought of it, that this is going to happen some 2,000 years later. Okay. Also in the New Testament, these documents affirm things that make us quite uncomfortable, affirming slavery, affirming patriarchy, condemning some same-sex relationships. Is how our spiritual ancestors saw things back then. It's not necessarily how we see them today. Things have changed. Context has changed. Different elements and background changes. We are over 2,000 years removed from that context and from that background. And so with that in mind, we have to remember that nothing stays static. Everything always continues to move forward. And with that, you then look at a lot of these letters and you go, well, how does this apply to me and my life? Well, there might be some wisdom there, but specifically for the reason it was written, it doesn't apply to your life. You don't own slaves. I don't own slaves. The commandment that is given to be good to your slaves really is irrelevant to those of us that are in our own background and context. Okay. So there is a threefold context that I showed you in these concentric circles. Just kind of keep those in mind. So the first context is the context of Jesus and early Christianity. And the most important thing to remember about this is that Jesus' historical context, when he lived, when he ministered, was Jewish, not Christian. So we can't superimpose Christian things upon Jesus. He was a Jewish boy that grew up under Judaism. He was a Torah observing rabbi. And so when you read the Gospels, you'll find that a lot of the things he says has to be contextualized. In other words, it has to be seen within his day and age. It's interesting that the New Testament never uses the word Christianity. That's a later development. And one of the things that pushes that forward is Paul's work. He begins to separate from Judaism, and he begins to push the work of Christ forward, and it'll eventually become Christianity. Now, those who are followers of Christ were usually called followers of the way of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, that type of thing. But as a religion, and specifically as a world religion, Christianity is not found in the New Testament. It's a work in progress. Does that make sense to everybody? Any thoughts there? The thing to keep in mind about the context of Judaism is that all the writers in the New Testament are Jewish, except Luke. Luke is probably Greek. The other thing to keep in mind, we're going to be looking at a specific kind of Judaism in the book of Galatians.
It's the kind of Judaism that wants to superimpose Torah law upon Gentile converts. That's not necessarily true. Just like there's a whole variety of different types of subcultures within one context, so too there's different types of Judaism that you'll run into as well in the New Testament. The one that we'll run into in the book of Galatians is pretty aggressive. And that's why Paul will use a lot of the very poignant and powerful language that he uses in the book of Galatians. When you read the book of Acts, which is written much later than the book of Galatians, you're going to find that Paul was chased from town to town on many of his missionary journeys, and he would be pushed from lo one locale to the next. And many times he didn't want to move on. He wished he could have stayed a little bit longer. And yet at the same time, out of fear for his own life, he had to move on. And it's that type of Judaism that we find that is very aggressive in trying to stamp out. We see that a little bit in the story of Acts chapter 7, when there's a type of Judaism that actually stones Stephen to death for the way he's telling the Jewish story. Acts chapter 7 is a long, long passage. Paul is found in Acts chapter 7 as kind of an individual sitting along the sidelines and approving of the stoning of Stephen because he is guilty of blasphemy. So the one thing, though, to keep in mind is that Judaism, even though it has a lot of diversity, it did have some shared convictions. And you see them on the screen there. Radical monotheism. There's one God. Again, coming out of Old Testament, that wasn't always the case. You had monolatry in the Old Testament. They worshiped Yahweh, but they also had some other gods on the side just for safekeeping as well. So there's also the promises and the hope of the covenants that are in the Old Testament that they shared in the covenant to Abraham, the covenant to David, that type of thing. And of course, there's different elements of Torah law. How strict of an observance? In Jesus' day, the Pharisees were pretty strict about observing Torah law, especially on the Sabbath. Not allowed to do work on the Sabbath, not allowed to heal on the Sabbath, not allowed to travel on the Sabbath. So they have a very tight way of looking at Torah law. You don't always have that. As the New Testament goes on, along, you see the grip is loosening a little bit on that, but not during Jesus' day and not in the early days where we find some of the earliest letters. Then finally, you have the context of the Roman Empire. And I don't think any of us have any idea how difficult it was for people to live under that dominant system. You'll see here, I mentioned there are four things about the Roman Empire that would be always in the background or in the context of living in the first century. Politically, you had no voice. There was political oppression. Shut up and do what we tell you to do. Number two, economically oppressive, overtaxed. Most people were poor. They didn't have enough money. Number three, chronic violence. What you find is there's not a whole lot of mercy under the Roman rule. You'll find that if you push back, they will definitely squash any type of rebellion very, very violently with a lot of bloodshed. And then finally, all of this is legitimated by their own religion. The Roman religion made certain claims, and you couldn't object to it. And it's found in the language that we'll see, even in the book of Galatians, where you see terms like Son of God, Lord, Savior, good news, or another word, gospel. Those are all terms Caesar used about himself. He was Lord. He was Savior. He was the Son of God. He was the one that gave good news that he would take care of the people as long as they obeyed his rule. And he would entertain them. And it would be called bread and circus, entertainment and provision of food, that type of thing. So even the language of the New Testament is within that context of the Roman Empire. There's pushback against the Roman rule. No, Caesar's not Son of God. Jesus is. No, Caesar's not Lord. Jesus is. So forth. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Those three concentric circles are very important to keep in the backdrop, not only of Galatians, but any document or letter that's in the New Testament. Any questions? Okay. Now, this is important too. Sometimes when we read the Bible, we think that this is exactly the way it happened. The majority of what's in the New Testament was based on oral tradition, not verbatim memory. Let me explain that a little bit. So oral tradition contains memory, but it's not the same thing as memorization. So when a crowd heard Jesus speaking a parable, when they heard Jesus give teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, they didn't sit there memorizing it. They began to hear the stories, and they began to share the stories. Now, a lot of times, and especially within evangelical Christianity, the superimposing of inerrancy upon the text makes it sound as though this is exactly the way it happened, and there's no error in it at all. That's not the way it developed. The way it develops is the followers of Jesus didn't memorize what he said, but they learned from his stories and his parables and his short sayings, and they would pass that along, and it would be repeated many different times over the course of years to different audiences. And that's the same thing that's true with Jesus. Jesus didn't teach the Sermon on the Mount one time or tell a parable one time. He, as an itinerant teacher, would have told these stories over and over again to different contexts, and different stories would then be applicable to different people. So with that comes this oral tradition, the tradition that has been held and told and passed on from one generation to the next. What we find is these traditions sometimes differ in different communities. In other words, the gist of Jesus' teaching can be emphasized in different ways depending upon where this teaching or story is being told. So the better word to use here is gist rather than memory. What we have in the New Testament is the gist of Jesus' teachings, and the gist of it is found in different communities. And so when they write documents, that's why there's differences in them, because it is applied in a different way and in a different setting. So sometimes traditions that are developed over a course of time will be not only remembered differently, but they will also be applied differently. So when you read through the Gospels, you'll come to what we call the Lord's Prayer, right? In Catholic communities, they reference it as the Our Father. Now, you read the Matthew account and you're reading through the New Testament, and then you find, oh, Luke has also a form of the Lord's Prayer too. But it's not the same. It's shortened. And the wording of it is different than in Matthew. And the question comes up, why? Well, Luke is writing later than Matthew. Luke is writing to a different audience. Luke is depending upon maybe different resources in writing his gospel than what Matthew did. So these differences does not mean they're one's right and one's wrong. It just means that they're applied and heard differently in different communities. And that's why background information to anything you read in the New Testament is so critically important. Authorship, audience, purpose of writing, those type of things. Any comments, any questions there? Okay, now this might be a surprise to you. All right, you have a chart here. This chart represents when the books of the New Testament are written. Look over here. You're going to see in the first column, you have 1 Thessalonians, Galatians, 1 and 2 Corinthians, and Philemon. Now, these are the 7 letters of Paul. You say, where do you get 7? Well, 2 Corinthians, it is believed, is actually 3 letters that have been combined together. So you have number 1, 1 Thessalonians, number 2, Galatians, number 3, 1 Corinthians, number 4, 2 Corinthians, number 5, 2 Corinthians, number 6, 2 Corinthians, and number 7, Philemon. So you have 7 letters there, even though it's only represented in the New Testament as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So what you have is they are the earliest writings of the New Testament. Observe that it is not based on the Gospels because the Gospels are not written yet. You get into the 70s and 80s, you have Philippians, Romans, and here we finally come to the first gospel, the shortest gospel, Mark. It is believed that Mark is a resource that was used by Matthew and Luke as well. So these are called the synoptic gospels because they sound so much alike. Then you have Colossians, Matthew, and Hebrews, which we don't even know who the author of that is. But these, it is believed to be written in the 70s and 80s. Now, notice how late some of these come in. It is believed by scholarship, not within fundamentalism. Fundamentalism will not allow any writings after 90 AD, basically. But most scholarship, and it's very technical, not something we're going to get into on our study, but most biblical scholars that are well-versed in this place John, Ephesians, Revelation, James, Jude, and 1st and 2nd, 3rd John in the between the 90s and 100s. And then after the 100s, between 100 and 110, you have Luke, Acts, 2nd Thessalonians, 1st Peter, 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, and Peter, 2nd Peter. And you go, well, if it's that late and Paul was martyred, according to the book of Acts, he couldn't have written Titus. He couldn't have written 1st and 2nd Timothy because he's already dead. He couldn't have written 2nd Thessalonians. So what you're going to find is it's here that you begin to see a distinction, maybe with a lot of things that you've been told in your church life. Because the letters, and there's 13 of them, are attributed to Paul, we think that he is the author. If you do some deeper digging, what you're going to find is you probably have 7 letters that are certainly written by Paul. There are some other letters that are written by Paul's associates in his name, and there are some that are highly unlikely written by Paul, and we don't even know who possibly penned the information. It does not necessarily mean these are not teachings of Paul. What it does mean, though, is that he's not the one that put the pen to paper. So I ask a question here. What do you find interesting or surprising about this timeline? Is this surprising to you? Now, a lot of times Christians will be dismissive of this. And they'll go, no. I just want to believe that Paul wrote 13 of these books, and that's the way it is. You've got to wrestle with the data. Just like in any field, you have to wrestle with the data. Sometimes some people come to one conclusion, sometimes they come to another. But what I, for our purposes, and we're not going to discuss this here, for our purposes, it's important to note that Galatians is probably either the first or second document written by Paul. There's some debate about whether it's 1 Thessalonians or Galatians that's the first one. But if you follow the book of Acts and you follow the missionary journeys in the book of Acts, it is more than likely, since Paul went into Thessalonica on his second missionary journey and into Galatia on his first missionary journey before the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 5, it's more most likely that Galatians is the very first letter written by Paul. So, thoughts there, comments there, questions there, concerns there? Anything?
What age is Paul at that point? Because it's 50s to 60s.
He is probably, scholars believe that he was not, a few years younger than Jesus. So he was a contemporary of Jesus, even though we'll see in the text in Galatia that he's not in Jerusalem. He grew up in Tarsus, which is up around the bend as you move into Asia Minor. So by the time you come to the 50s and 60s, if Jesus died at the age of 30 or 33, which is the common, and you add 20 years to that, or 30 years to that, Paul was in his 50s or 60s, more than likely, when these letters are being written.
So then all the later ones are written by...
The later ones could be possible. You mean Paul's letters, or are you talking about
just
other...
in general?
In general. You have within this a question. How long did these other individuals live? Mark, yeah. Matthew, John. We know John lived to a long age because there is church history that suggests he was the mentor to Polycarp, and there's a bunch of reasons why it's believed that John lived into his old age. Peter, James, Matthew, Mark, you know, there's different traditions. Remember how we said in church history, it's believed that all of the disciples were martyred, possibly except John, the elder. So I don't know. I mean, you know, you can try to guess at the age, but, you know, they did not die young, I wouldn't say, but they didn't necessarily live as long as John did. So. All right, here we go. So why does this even matter? Why does it matter that Paul and not the Gospels is the earliest witness to the story of Jesus? Well, Mark is the first gospel witness, dated around 70 CE or AD, whichever way you want to turn it. These letters are not composed, though, bubble. They do represent the context or the realities and pressures of the world that they're in. The problem is that we have been taught to kind of read Paul's letters as if he's writing a systematic theology, especially the book of Romans, and we'll see even here in Galatians, in the way that this book influenced Martin Luther. In reality, most of the New Testament documents or letters, the main goal of these letters is to hold two differing types of people together in unity, Gentiles and Jews, most precisely. And we talked about that when we were studying the book of Romans a while back. The various letters are reflecting a new type of movement that's allowing Gentiles to come first into Judaism and then develop from that into the early years of the church. And these different letters are not unaffected by this ethnic tension between Jews and Gentiles. It's there, it's in the background all the time. And all the things that we read in the news or hear on the TV about how we've got to build a wall, we've got to build a wall, we've got to protect our group. That is very much alive in the New Testament as well. And so you can see what a challenge Paul has in trying to build a bridge. And as he says in Ephesians, he says to break down that middle wall of partition between the Jews and the Gentiles. So he is trying to articulate the story of Jesus within his own set of circumstances. But what he knows of Jesus has been told to him, first of all, by oral tradition, and secondly, by direct revelation. When we get into Galatians, we're going to see that he makes a claim that he goes into Arabia for a period of time where supposedly he has direct mystical experience with Jesus, and he has been taught by the Lord directly. So chronology is important, context is important as you get into the book of Galatians. Now, the composition of the letters of Paul as the earliest sources of New Testament letters is that he gives to us the closest proximity to the historical Jesus. So, if, as you see in that chart, Galatians is written, let's say, even if you back it up into the late 40s, 48 to 50 AD, well, you're 10 at the earliest to 18 years after the life of Christ. So, there's some time in between, and yet at the same time, he gives to us the closest proximity, history-wise, time-wise, to Jesus. So I mentioned just a moment ago about the seven letters of which we're certain Paul wrote, and out of those 13, there are six of them that are debated about authorship. And knowing this about Paul and the historical context will help us recognize how he is writing in those seven letters. He's very aggressive. When you think about the letters of Galatians, 1 Corinthians, and 2 Corinthians, he does not mince words too much to these congregations. And we're going to find that in Galatians. He's pretty hard-hitting. What we do see is because he is the closest to the historical person of Jesus, he becomes the most important person in the New Testament because he is an individual that begins to write things down. Now, he did not know he was writing the New Testament. He did not think that someday these things were all going to be collected and copied and distributed. He was just writing to the Corinthians. He was just writing to the Thessalonians. He was just writing to the Galatians. So when you put these letters together, connected to Paul in some way, and then half of the book of Acts, I mean, over half of a very long book, and it's really, other than the Gospels, it's the only narrative that you have in the New Testament. Over half of it is about Paul and about his life, about how he came to Christ, about his missionary journeys, about his imprisonment, that type of thing. Okay, so those are things that we keep in the back of our mind as well. So let's ask the question for a moment, who is Paul? So I mentioned this before, I mentioned it again on this slide. Paul's Jewish. He's not Christian at this point. Now, by that, I don't mean he doesn't know Christ. He meets Christ on the Damascus Road, Acts chapter 9. But Christianity, as we know it, churches, identifiable language like I'm a Christian, is very, very early. He, like Jesus, is trying in many respects to be a revisionist of Judaism. When Jesus taught, he said, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." He begins to try to revise a lot of the things that they've been told or the way that they apply it. Paul is kind of in the same vein. He is an individual that begins in the synagogues. That's where he begins to tell his story, and that's where he begins to talk about Jesus. And he's Jewish through and through. He never stopped being Jewish his entire life. And he certainly didn't change religions from one religion to another religion. He allowed these revisions that he believed to be from God to evolve, to process, to emerge. And so the New Testament, in many respects, is a process development. You'll see here that Jesus taught certain things about the way they should look at the law, but he was still looking at his world through a Jewish lens. That's the same thing with Paul. He's not doing anything different than Jesus. Jesus began this community of nonviolent resistors against Roman occupation within Judaism, and this led to this vision of Paul eventually trying to combine both Jews and Gentiles into this new movement or this new revision that began with Jesus. So what you find taking place is now both Jews and Gentiles have a different way of looking at the world, a different way of perceiving life. And so that's a lot of what Paul's trying to do in these letters. So historically, he's Jewish, he's continuing the work of Jesus, and he's addressing specific congregants. Secondly is his conversion. We don't know really Paul's breadth of knowledge about Jesus prior to his conversion. He came from a wealthy family. He grew up in Tarsus. He at one point appeals to his Roman citizenship. He's an individual that had a little bit of influence by his education, and really don't know what his parents did by way of occupation. But at the same time, not everyone had the type of educational opportunities that Paul did, known at that time as Saul. What we do know is that what he actually tells us about the historical Jesus, when you actually read the letters, is very scant. There's more implications about the life and work and ministry of Jesus than there is actual references to historical episodes in the life of Jesus. And that's, again, reinforcing that his letters are occasional. They are written to address specific issues. But nevertheless, in the book of Acts, we're told that initially he was a persecutor of Christians, not known as Christians at that time, but the reformists of Judaism, which he didn't like, and he wanted it to stop. And as he was on his way to a community in Damascus, it is there that he is blinded. It is there that Christ meets him, and it is there that his whole world turns around. He is an individual that will give an account of that conversion experience three times in the book of Acts. What's interesting is when you read that story three times in the book of Acts, each story differs a little bit. Again, this is a document that's being written decades, even after the end of his life. So it's being remembered in different ways by the Luke and those who assisted him in writing Luke Acts. The one thing that Paul does talk about after this conversion experience is salvation. One thing is for certain, he doesn't use the word salvation in the same way church lingo, churchianity does. Most of the time when you hear the word salvation in church, it's all about going to heaven after you die. You got to begin to clear that out. It's a much bigger concept. It includes that. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, those type of verses. However, have you noticed that the New Testament does not tell us a whole lot about heaven? Have you noticed that? That's why preachers, when they do a memorial service, always just go to John 14. There's not a lot of descriptive elements there. He talks a little bit about eye has not seen and ear has not heard about the wonderful things that God has prepared for those who love him. But that's not the description of streets of gold. That's because salvation in Paul's writings is a big concept. It's not a narrow idea of you need to say a prayer so that you can go to heaven after you die. The idea of salvation, we'll get into this in the book of Galatians, is built upon the Exodus. It's built upon deliverance. It's built upon being freed from those things that are holding you back and preventing you from living a full life. The way I put it at the bottom of the screen there is that salvation is about liberation more than evacuation. Okay. So we're almost done. I mentioned a little bit ago about some of the controversial letters. I'm just going to be here for a split second. You'll notice here that there's some question about Colossians, Ephesians, and 2 Thessalonians, and there's real debate about the pastoral letters. It's just a whole different feel. This is a much more developed idea about the church, about its hierarchy, and about its leadership. The idea of elders, the idea of deacons, those type of things don't appear in any of Paul's writings. It only appears in the pastoral epistles, which makes a lot of scholars believe that these letters are much later than even his lifespan. Again, it doesn't change the message of the books. What it does do is it helps us to understand maybe some of the controversial statements that are in Titus and 1st and 2nd Timothy are things that have been built upon Paul's previous letters, built upon his previous teachings in the documents he wrote. So you can take that or leave that for what it's worth, but that's the type of conversations that are often found in biblical scholarship. So the uncontested letters, of which Galatians is is apart, we don't have to worry about that. I already mentioned that the New Testament is based in the order of the letters on their length and not on their date of composition. The thing to remember is when we read the documents of Paul, we're reading someone else's mail. And we have to keep in mind the original context. If we don't, we're going to misapply what it means for us. Now, here's an interesting angle. I added this later this afternoon, and so you don't have this. But there is a big difference between the way Catholics and Protestants look at Paul. Let me explain. They see the importance of Paul differently. So Catholics see Paul as supplemental to the importance of Peter and the centrality of Jesus. So more than likely, when you're in a Catholic church, you probably will not turn open as often to the letters of Paul as you will the Gospels. Okay? You'll hear more often readings from the Gospels. Protestants, on the other hand, see Paul as kind of central to the technical terms of justification, sanctification, redemption, ransom, those type of terms. Often Catholics find Paul a little bit distasteful because it's in his writings you find issues on slavery, misogyny, different things like that, that since Catholics more than Protestants are concerned about social justice, they do not think that the writings of Paul are very productive for achieving that. On the other hand, Protestants find Paul appealing because it's the basis for the Reformation. So Galatians and Romans are two letters that are kind of like spark plugs for the engine of the Reformation. So I think it's important to just kind of realize that there are differences between brothers and sisters within the faith that have different emphasis on different things, okay? It's kind of the way they arrange their theological bedroom, okay? What I mean by that is we're all working with the same thing, but we arrange things differently, okay? So, again, context matters. So we'll dive into that next week as we get into the context of Galatians. Here's what I do want you to take with you tonight as we kind of wind down. In the first decades of this movement, you find that two areas, Thessalonica and Galatia, are of primary importance. And the reason is that's where Paul first took his journeys. First into Galatia, that's told in Acts 13 and 14. And then in the second missionary journey, he went up into Thessalonica. And so he travels. He's kind of like a visiting rabbi, moving from town to town. He teaches initially in the synagogues, and primary focus is upon Jews. But later he will begin when he receives a vision. It's called the Macedonian vision. It's found in Acts chapter 10, to come on over into a more Gentile dominant area, that he'll begin to see the importance of incorporating Gentiles into this movement as well. So what I want to kind of close off tonight is with two things, recognizing that Gentiles are being drawn into this circle. And as they are being drawn into this circle, Paul will begin to de-emphasize things like circumcision, dietary laws, and Sabbath observance. He does some very creative things in his writings as well. He will begin to connect Old Testament scriptures to Jesus, But to do that, he will do some midrash. He will begin to change some things around. And we're going to see in Galatians, he makes a big deal about Sarah and Hagar, of Abraham's fame. And you read that and go, where did he get this? For heaven's sake. Oh, one represents this and the other one represents this. Well, you read that in Genesis, that's not nowhere to be found. So he does some very creative things, and we'll deal with that when we get to it. So, last thing I want to mention here today is, and we'll get into this next week when we're actually talking about Galatians. All of this is kind of backdrop to all the New Testament documents. So, I guess the question is, did believers in Jesus need to come to him through the rites and rituals of Judaism? Just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. I'll reuse a couple of these slides next week. And the thing I want to close with today is I mentioned Paul's letters is in many ways the foundation of the Reformation in the 16th century. Perhaps you did not know this. A lot of the big words of the Reformation, justification, grace, faith, sanctification, all of these are big words that come out of Paul's letters. Now, notice what Martin Luther does. He considers Galatians to be the very center of the gospel. And at one point, he called the letter Mycadee, which is interesting because his wife's name was Catherine. And so he saw Galatians as kind of his spouse, you might say. That's how important it was. Here's how he got to that. He began lecturing on Galatians in October 1516, and he continued to preach and teach on it through the spring of 1517. That is an entire year of teaching before he actually then writes up the 95 theses and posts them on the Wittenberg door. And so in many ways, the book of Galatians is the steroid, you might say, that propels him to write the 95 theses, and that then begins to get the momentum of the Reformation going. He will later write a commentary on the book of Galatians in 1519, and this is the book that will influence Saint Augustine of church history fame that we talked about. And and Saint Augustine is the biggest influence on John Calvin as well. And all of these things are very, very interesting connections. So that's where I want to close for tonight. Do you have some thoughts, some questions, anything that you want to mention before we finish up our time tonight?
Good. Thank you.
Okay, I know it's a bit heavy to kind of work through that, but you're going to see how it connects as we get into the book of Galatians, okay? So thanks for your patience.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
Thank you.
You have a great weekend. All right, we'll see you soon.
Good night.
Good night.
No. Thank